Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. For those of you who are new to the podcast, especially those of you watching it on YouTube for the first time, first, welcome. And second, I want to let you know that on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend our Catholic faith. From time to time, I release rebuttal videos of anti-Catholic videos on YouTube. If you want to check out more of that, be sure to click the subscribe button over on YouTube, or go and leave a review for us and subscribe at iTunes or Google Play for the audio podcast. So we do that on Tuesdays, Thursdays. We also do rebuttal videos. But on Fridays on the podcast, I just like to have fun. I just talk about whatever I find to be really interesting. And all different kinds of things inspire me to do Free for All Fridays. Usually I'll just be going about my daily life and something seems interesting. And I think, you know, that would be really cool to talk about on a Friday episode. So there's been a lot in the news recently about Dr. Seuss. You know, oh, Dr. Seuss is canceled. Dr. Seuss is racist. And it is interesting. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But the more I was looking into the story, it made me question, and I was really wondering, how did kids learn to read before Dr. Seuss? How do we learn to read at all? Because if you think about it, human beings, we're hardwired to speak. We're not hardwired to read. Throughout the course of human history, the vast majority of people, I would say 99.5% of the human race, let's say you go all the way back to before civilization. So you go back to whenever you want to date the modern human race arising. So you're going back tens of thousands of years throughout human history. If you go back and include all of those people, the vast majority of human beings who have ever lived did not know how to read. Literacy is something that did not arise until the modern world. Because, you know, it's interesting, people who say, oh, the Catholic Church locked up Bibles so people couldn't read them. Well, they did lock up illuminated manuscripts that were really, really valuable for the same reason you lock your car. Books were extremely expensive in the Middle Ages. They were kept in safekeeping, but it wouldn't have mattered. It's not like they were keeping them away from the peasants because the peasants couldn't read. Most people could not read until the production of the printing press during, when was that? The 16th century, because obviously the Protestant Reformation, well, 15th, 16th century, you have Gutenberg's printing press, and then reading starts to take off. But even still, up until really in the past century, a large number of people, and in some communities, the majority were illiterate. So that's why in today's episode, I wanted to talk about Dr. Seuss, but also just about learning to read, what people did before that. Because, I mean, you think about it, if you go to a foreign country, and you learn by immersion, you could pick up the language. If in a year you're in a foreign country and you're just interacting with people, you can pick up the language. Children, you know, children naturally learn to imitate what we say. I mean, I'm amazed that like my kids when they're 2 or 3 years old, the kind of conversations they can have with me. Speaking comes very naturally to human beings. We need that for survival. It makes sense that if you're going to survive in a community of human beings, you have to be able to communicate with them. So speaking comes naturally. Reading is just a lot different. And my children are learning to read right now. And I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud of my son, Matthew, when he is reading through these words, because it's hard. And the English language is just weird. The English language is weird. It's island instead of island, for example. It's knight. The knight rides a horse, not the knigget, you know, whatever it might be. So it's very strange. So teaching kids how to read is very difficult, and Dr. Seuss should be commended for that. But there's a controversy. According to CNBC, 6 Dr. Seuss books will be discontinued because of racist and insensitive imagery, including And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street and If I Ran the Zoo. The Dr. Seuss Enterprises, which handles publishing his books, says these books portray people in ways that are hurtful and wrong. I think the other books are McGilligot's Pool, On Beyond Zebra, Scrambled Eggs Super, and The Cat's Quizzer. So not the most famous books. I mean, when you say he's been canceled, if you notice in the thumbnail for the video, I put canceled with 3 question marks just to encourage discussion, because I wouldn't call this being canceled. You can still buy the vast majority of Dr. Seuss books. And the thing is, it's the author's publisher the people who control Dr. Seuss's intellectual property, that made the voluntary decision to not release these books anymore. It'd be the same if I, as an author, said, you know what, I want to redo my first books, like Answering Atheism or Persuasive Pro-Life. I'm not either not going to sell them anymore, or I'm going to do a second edition and I'm phasing out the first edition because there's things in it that I'm not happy with. An author has the right to do that. So I don't necessarily call that canceling. So you need to really walk a fine line here. On the one hand, I don't like cancel culture. I don't like a culture that lacks nuance, reflection, that dishes out punishment and is not willing to look at an author or an artist and his work, or even just a regular person on Twitter. They just want to be punitive for the sake of causing misery to someone because they're being self-righteous and even vengeful. I don't like that. But on the other hand, people do things at one point in history, and then as you get older and you mature or society grows and develops, you look back and say, that might not have been the best idea. So, for example, this is one of the illustrations from If I Ran the Zoo. It says, if I ran the zoo, I'll go to the African island of Yerka and bring back a tizzle-toff tufted mazurka. And so it shows this animal here. The animal's being carried, I think, by what are supposed to be two African pygmies or two African natives. But the way that they're drawn is a racist stereotype. So I can see, it's not great. So, all right, so that's the extent of the controversy that I want to cover. Now I want to focus on some facts about Dr. Seuss you probably never knew, and how he revolutionized teaching children to read. So the first fact, the one that blew my mind when doing research for this episode, is that we're all getting Dr. Seuss's name wrong. We're all mispronouncing it. It's not Dr. Seuss, it's Dr. Zeus, because it's German. Theodor Geisel. His full name is Theodor Zeus Geisel. It's a German name. It's not Seuss doesn't rhyme with goose. It rhymes with voice. This is an article, ironically, by Dan Kois. And he says his name rhymes with Dr. Seuss's name. It's Dr. Zeus. So you even need like the Z for the S to get that German pronunciation right. It's Dr. Zeus. Now, why did he sign his books Dr. Zeus? Now, you know what? I'm going to say Seuss, Dr. Seuss, because it just feels more natural. So I know that I'm perpetuating a fiction here, but you know what? Dr. Seuss perpetuated all kinds of ridiculous fictions in his books. I'm going to do the same because we're used to that. So I might go back and forth a bit. So it rhymes with Zeus, but the reason he picked this name, so it's Theodor Geisel. He signed it Dr. Seuss because he wanted to be the next great, he wanted to write the next great American novel. So he really focused on that. But Seuss began his career doing a lot of illustrations. His first illustrations weren't even for children's books. They're for books dealing with silly mistakes, I think, that college students would make in papers or mistakes that people made. This was published, I think, back in the 1940s or 30s. I think it was the 40s. And the book he illustrated for was, I'm not kidding, The Pocket Book of Boners. Of course, boner today is a naughty term, but back then he wrote illustrations for boner meant a mistake you would make. So he illustrated, I think, the book Boners, More Boners, and The Pocketbook of Boners. So now you know that's what he pronounced. He picked, obviously, Seuss or Zeus as the pen name, because he didn't want his name associated with that. He's like, okay, that's what Dr. Seuss does, and then Theodor Geisel will write the next Great Gatsby. Of course, he became famous for his children's books. So he picked Zeus or Zeus as the middle name. He used doctor because he went to Oxford, but he never actually got his doctorate. So it's a nod to how he didn't end up getting his doctorate. So, but then he became very famous for his children's books, of course. He was only known for his illustrations. Cat in the Hat is really when he took off. Though pro-life advocates have really seen the pro-life message in Horton Hears a Who. You know, remember Horton Hears a Who about the elephant who is aware of the Whos of Whoville, and nobody else recognizes the Whos that are alive, and Horton is trying to save them even though nobody else can see that they're people. And he says that famous line, a person's a person, no matter how small. Well, there is a dispute about the political leanings of Dr. Seuss and his widow, who oversaw his estate after his death, and she really didn't like it when pro-life advocates used Dr. Seuss's work, like Horton Hears a Who, in their pro-life work. She claims that she just wanted Dr. Seuss's work to be apolitical, not to be involved for or against abortion. But there have been people at Operation Rescue, that older pro-life group, who claimed that they have documentation proving that Dr. Seuss and his wife supported Planned Parenthood, that they were pro-choice. So I don't have all the research on that. I'm just letting you know there is a controversy related to it. But he certainly, it's interesting when pro-life advocates want to use resources to promote the pro-life view, some of the best pro-life resources are created by pro-choice people, or at least people who are not friendly to the pro-life cause. So Horton Hears a Who is a great pro-life story for kids, even though Dr. Seuss did not intend to make it a pro-life story. The best photographs of unborn children come from the book A Child is Born by Leonard Nielsen. Nielsen is pro-choice, and he does not give pro-life advocates permission to use his book A Child is Born. So, okay, so those are the interesting facts about Dr. Seuss. Now let's talk a little bit about how Dr. Seuss revolutionized teaching kids how to read. So before Dr. Seuss published Cat in the Hat in 1957, it was in the mid-1950s, most kids were learning to read with the Dick and Jane primers. So Read with Dick and Jane, Fun with Dick and Jane, Dick and Jane Go to the Zoo. I don't know if that's a real one, but it's just a story about two little kids, Dick and Jane, their father and mother, who are just your stereotypical like 1940s mother and father. Dad wears a hat and a suit. Mom's got her dress on. Oh, and baby Sally. And so they learned from these Dick and Jane primers, and people loved them. I mean, tens of millions of people bought these books and learned to read with them. I know some people today who still use the Dick and Jane primers, but I will tell you this, they're not the most riveting stories. They're not the most fun for kids to read. So here's one. I think this is from Fun with Dick and Jane. It's chapter one. Dick and Jane are by a bush, and they see a hat over the bush, and they're like, what is it? And so it turns out it's the dad, and baby Sally is on dad's shoulders wearing dad's hat. So Dick said, look, look, look up, up, up. Jane said, run, 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 Dick, run, run and see. Look, look, said Dick, see Sally. That's baby Sally on dad's shoulders. See funny Sally and father. I guess that's the crazy part of the story when Sally's wearing dad's hat. Whoa, let's not get too crazy here. The baby's wearing dad's hat. You can see how right now how Dr. Seuss with his elaborate worlds and characters and zany adventures, how you're just jumping into hyperdrive when the craziest thing in Dick and Jane is that baby Sally is wearing daddy's hat. CC said Sally. Sally is up, up, up. This is fun for Sally. Oh, man, I'm really glad I don't have to read Dick and Jane primers to my kids. So they're released in 1934. And another problem with them, and I'll talk about this here in a second when we talk about how kids really were stifled in learning to read in the early part of the 20th century, was that they use sight reading. They teach kids to read not by sounding out the words, but by just recognizing the word after they've seen it repeated enough, which isn't the best way to teach kids how to read. They were written by, I think, a former elementary school teacher, Zerna Sharp. And she said that the Dick and Jane book, she was trying to improve the previous reading primers that came before her. So you shouldn't give Dick and Jane too hard of a time, because it really did improve reading primers from the 19th century that, you know, make Dick and Jane look like a roller coaster ride. And so Zerna Sharp said, there's nothing these book children, Dick and Jane, could do that actual children couldn't remember having done themselves. We made reading easy for them and encouraged them to read more. So the goal with the Dick and Jane primers is to say, look, we want stories that kids reading it will say, I've hidden by the bush in the front yard and seen daddy come up. They wanted to make the books really connect with what kids were normally doing and draw them into reading in that way. And so it is an improvement from the previous ones. This is a book here. If you can see, you should definitely go to YouTube, by the way. If you're just watching on the podcast, subscribe at YouTube, because it's really interesting to see what these primers look like. This is one, it's called The Children's Primer. It's written in 1894, and it's not even a story. It's just sentences. So when you get up to Dick and Jane in the 1930s, the primers change so they're more narrative in function. That kids learn to read by reading a story about other kids like them. And then Dr. Seuss amps it up with all these kind of zany stories. But before that, when you go to the 19th century, a children's primer to learn to read, it's just really just sentences over and over. See my slate. Mama can see my slate. I don't know why it's British. It'd be the 19th century. They're not British people in America, but that's what I imagine. It looks like something you'd read in Victorian England, and it probably did. Mama can see my book. See my slate, baby. See my book, baby. I have a doll. Baby can see my doll. Baby can see my book. Baby can see my slate. Kitty can see my book. You see, and now it's interesting, when my kids really, really first started to read, I remember that they had little books I would read to them, and the sentences were, you know, the sentences were only about, I don't know, 4 words long. There might have been 3 or 4 distinct words in each sentence. But the people who wrote these little primers my kids use today, they still have a story. People love reading to see, well, what happens in the story. And so this children's primer, it's not about a story at all. You go on the other page, you got this creepy picture of a kid holding a cat. I'm not sure if the cat is alive or not. I don't know, but he's just your typical creepy Victorian era child. I like Willie to play. I can see Willie. Willie has a kitty. Willie has a book. Like, oh, I can't look at Willie anymore. He's creepy. So it was better. So the Dick and Jane primers improved on that. But the problem was, when you look at literacy rates, this is interesting. When you look at literacy rates going from the year 1870 to 1980, it's fascinating. When you look at the total population as a whole, there's actually a big disparity here between African Americans and whites. And that makes sense. When you look in the year 1870, this is just 10 years after the Civil War. So many African Americans were slaves. They'd never learned how to read. And so in 1870, black illiteracy, people who couldn't read, was at about 80%, though whites were about 11%. Still, 1 out of 10 white people couldn't read in 1870. 4 out of 5 black people couldn't read. When you go to 1979, however, white illiteracy drops to 0.4%. Black illiteracy drops to 1.6%, still much higher than white illiteracy in 1979. And the gap has continued to close since then. But if you go to just the general population as a whole, in 1870, 20% of people in the U.S. could not read. That drops to 10% in the year 1900. So in 30 years, from 1870 to 1900, it drops to 10%, probably with the Industrial Revolution. People have to learn how to read manuals and read signs. You're going into a city, there's signs for everything. You've got urbanization. And it continues to drop to around 3% in 1930 till about 1950. During this period, it kind of stays stagnant at around 3% from 1940 to 1947, 2.9 to 2.7. From 1947 to 1950, illiteracy goes up from 2.7% to 3.2%. So it becomes really stagnant around 2 to 3% until 1969, it drops to 1%. So we've got this period from 1930 to 1960 where there's a segment of the population, we're not able to crack that illiteracy rate. There's still 3% of the population that can't read, you know, even though we're going at this for decades now. What's going on? Well, that motivated Rudolph Flesch to write a book in 1955 called Why Johnny Can't Read and What You Can Do About It. Why Johnny Can't Read, hence the title of this podcast, Why Johnny Needs Dr. Seuss to Read. The Johnny I'm talking about, of course, is your typical Johnny from like the 1950s. Johnny knows how to be a good boy, but unfortunately, Johnny can't read a book to save his life. So why Johnny can't read? Rudolph Flesch wrote this in 1955, and this is what he says. Since the 1920s, most American school children have been taught to memorize the appearance of words one after another, like Chinese characters, without reference to the sounds of the individual letters that make up each word. By this word method, which we would call sight reading, largely developed at teachers' colleges and schools of education, children must plow through endless illustrated stories in which words are repeated over and over. Remember on the Dick and Jane primer, Dick said, look, look, look up, look up, up, up. Jane said, run, 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 Dick, run. That's sight reading. You just want the kid to recognize seeing the word, not necessarily how you sound the word out. So Flesch points out then that this method, he says here, like, you know, quack, quack, said the duck. He wanted something. He did not want to get out. He did not want to go to the farm. He did not want to eat. He sat and sat and sat. So Flesch goes on, under the word method, if a child comes up against a new word, all he can do is guess, not at its pronunciation, but at its looks. And that's bad in the English language. Words can look one way, but they sound quite different. As a result, says Flesh, sorry, this is from an article, but it includes excerpts from Why Johnny Can't Read. Word method pupils make outlandish errors, reading said for jumped, caps instead of houses. One youngster who had successfully recognized the word children on a word recognition card was unable to read it on the printed page. And so they asked this kid, so you could recognize, you can read children when it's on your flashcard, but not in a book. Why? And he told the teachers, by the smudge over in the corner of the card. So he knew that card was children because it had a smudge on it, not by what it said, because he was used to sight reading. And so in Why Johnny Can't Read, actually, Flesh criticizes the Dick and Jane primers for perpetuating this kind of sight reading mentality. And so he argued for a phonics-based approach. And it wasn't until 1987 that the most famous phonics-based approach, Hooked on Phonics, debuted in the market, became an instant hit. I still remember, this is how I learned how to read. I remember my mom playing the little tapes at home, the little Hooked on Phonics cassette tapes. I still remember you open the big plastic sleeve. It had like a dozen cassette tapes in it. And if you remember this too, if that's how you learned to read with the cassette tape, leave a comment either under the video or at trendhornpodcast.com in our Patreon community. Would love to hear from other cassette tape Hooked on Phonics veterans like myself. Though my kids today, I get them this, learn to read, and there's a DVD, and so they watch and listen in that way. Whereas when I was their age, I did the Hooked on Phonics cassette. And then, of course, Cat in the Hat was very good at using phonics in its approach in order to teach kids how to read. Academic Lewis Manan, this is what he says. He says, "The Cat in the Hat transformed the nature of primary education and the nature of children's books. It not only stood for the idea that reading ought to be taught by phonics, it also stood for the idea that language skills and many other subjects ought to be taught through illustrated storybooks rather than primers and textbooks." Now, Seuss himself, Zeus, I'm going to call him Zeus, I don't care. Seuss was frustrated because they told him, all right, you need to tell a story, but you can only use these 50 or 60 words. And he got frustrated with those words, so he picked the first two words on the list as the title and subject of the story. And the first two rhyming words were cat and hat. And then it became an instant success, and after that, though, let's wrap it back to the present here. There's the Dr. Seuss controversy. Now, here's the thing. You say, well, Dr. Seuss isn't canceled. It's just, you know, when I went to the zoo, Cat's Quizzer. It's not the most famous books. But I won't be surprised if Cat in the Hat, if Dr. Seuss chooses to not. I don't know. I don't know if they'll ever stop publishing Cat in the Hat because it is just so famous. It is so famous. It'd be like if Disney decided not to release Peter Pan anymore, even though Peter Pan has some stuff in it where I'm like, kids, don't sing Why is the Red Man Red when we're at the grocery store. You know, I don't think they'll ever pull Cat in the Hat, but there's criticism that Cat in the Hat is racist. Philip Nell is an academic who wrote a book back in 2014 called Was the Cat in the Hat Black? And he claims that there's these racist images in Dr. Seuss, and the Cat in the Hat is one of them, that the Cat in the Hat is actually a stereotype of African-American minstrels. So, take that what you will from it, but just don't be surprised if that's what comes out in the future, that they'll come for that. You know, we'll see what happens. So, all righty. Well, thank you so much for sharing Free For All Friday with me. I hope you learned a lot about Dr. Seuss or Dr. Zeus. We should call him Dr. Zeus, or the und Cat in the Hat. So about Dr. Seuss, and just about how kids learn to read. How did you learn to read? What was the first book that you read? What was the first book that you remember reading as a kid? Do you still have it around? Does it bring back memories of learning to read? Leave a comment under the video. Click subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. If you're listening to this on the podcast, check us out on YouTube. Go and click subscribe there. And if you like videos like this, if you're enjoying podcasts like this, become a premium subscriber at trendhornpodcast.com, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, our catechism study series, and you help the podcast to grow, our YouTube channel to grow. Always a great thing to do. Check us out at trendhornpodcast.com. Thank you all so much, and I hope you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.